Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecelloSherpa.com or follow us on Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube at The Cello Sherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. If you're looking for a bit of extra help on learning your orchestra or solo repertoire, perhaps we can help. Visit www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. My friend and colleague, cellist Emily Wright, invited me to join her on her podcast for an interview. So if you're interested in checking it out and hearing the tables turned on me, head on over to the Lonely Cello Podcast, which you can find on Apple, Spotify, or SoundCloud. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is cellist Ken Kubota. Ken has shattered perceptions of the typical classical music career, as he is most known as a YouTuber, a social media personality, and for pioneering his unique style of strumming the cello like a guitar. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you have an incredible social media following with over 80,000 followers on Instagram, nearly 35,000 followers on TikTok, 47,000 followers on YouTube, and videos that have generated nearly 6 million views over the past 8 years. How have you managed to create this incredible following?
It initially started not even as a venture into social media space with the intention of growing. Mm-hmm. I started all of this because I was taking a music technology class at Juilliard during my grad school years. And part of the assignment was to produce tracks utilizing some of the features that we were learning in the class, you know, such as like maybe 1 week we learned about how to use reverb or we learned how to use EQ and compression. So as long as we use that concept, the kind of track that we were creating didn't really matter. So I have a lot of passion for listening to pop music and jazz-influenced music. So the kind of tracks that I was creating for my assignments and my classes tended to be pop covers. Mm-hmm. I would just kind of bring in my friends that were in my class or my close friends, and we would just do a pop cover. I would produce it utilizing the things we learned in class, and then I would upload these onto SoundCloud. Mm-hmm. And I took this class and the different iterations and the levels of this class. So by the time I was getting ready to graduate, I had a portfolio of what I thought were pretty well-produced pop cover tracks. And I was excited about them and I wanted people to hear it. So through my process of uploading it to SoundCloud, I was hoping that people would take note of my hard work and my efforts in my class. And, you know, the reality is that nobody checks it out. So I was kind of sad and bummed about it.
Yeah.
And I learned around that time that there was this platform called Instagram, which to me was, I thought at the time, was just a photo editing app. I didn't realize that it was like a social media application. So I used to just edit photos on them. I also didn't know that they were getting posted, but that's a thing for another time. I started posting little clips of me doing, at the time, the video limit was, I think, like 15 seconds.
Okay.
So I announced to my following of like 100 or some people on my Instagram that I was going to start doing 15-second covers every Tuesday and Friday. And through that, that was my intention of trying to drive my friends or whoever wanted to watch to my SoundCloud. That was my end game,
the
time.
Yeah.
Of just trying to get people to listen to the hard work that I put into my assignments, which was kind of funny at the time. But that is how it started. I committed to a certain schedule and I would just rope my friends in at school at Juilliard, I would just be walking around the practice floor, recruiting whoever looked like they weren't practicing. Or he would just be sitting in their practice room, maybe taking a break. And I would be like, hey, do you want to do this like 15-second video with me? I'm doing this series. And through doing that, I think consistently, I ended up keeping that schedule, the every Tuesday and Friday schedule, until I hit video like number 500. So as it progressed, the length of my videos also became longer. And as they became longer, I started posting them on YouTube because it was a much more fitting place for longer form videos. Mm-hmm. But even for YouTube, for me, since my main platform at the time was Instagram, or so I thought, I ended up just using YouTube as my archival purposes.
Yeah.
Just so, you know, like on Instagram, once you start scrolling, it's like, it doesn't really have as good of like a search function. So if I wanted to find like an old video, I literally have to kind of keep scrolling.
Oh, okay.
Over and over to like find the video.
Yeah.
So just for my like archival purposes, I started just uploading all the videos that I had been making for Instagram, or like the longer cuts that didn't make it into the 15-second limit. And eventually Instagram made it longer to like a minute. And now it's a little bit longer. So I was just dumping it all into YouTube. And just because I was doing that, it like started to grow a following over there. And I guess the consistency that I was pumping out content on Instagram also helped grow that platform. And that was kind of how the initial, I guess, burst of following came, was through doing these pop covers that is called JHM Jams. That's the series where we have a rotating roster of classical and jazz musicians that just come in, and in about a 2-hour span, we learn it by ear, we arrange it by ear, and just record it and just throw it out into the world. So that's the series that I started in grad school.
Wow.
Casually, yeah.
Okay, so first of all, I assume JHM, the J is for Juilliard. What's the rest of that stand for?
Initially, not that it stands for this anymore, but it used to stand for Juilliard House Mafia.
Uh-huh.
And this was, at the time, one of my very close friends and my old roommate, Nathan Chan. He's also a cellist.
Yep.
And he and I lived in the same apartment, and we're both very big fans of electronic dance music, EDM.
Yeah.
And there's a DJ group called the Swedish House Mafia.
Okay.
That we enjoy listening to. So he just thought it would be funny to name our apartment Wi-Fi Juilliard House Mafia. So it was literally just our Wi-Fi name. And when I started this project, I just needed like a place to put all of these videos and the projects just in my computer. So when I made a folder, I just put in JHM,
yeah,
or Juilliard House Mafia, because this was just where I was making it. And it was just kind of like a funny name to me. And the iteration of JHM Jams just was like an idea from one of my other friends, Drew Ford. He goes by That Viola Kid.
Yeah, he came from Atlanta, so I know exactly who that is.
Yeah. So like Nathan and Drew were my first, I guess, mentors into the social media space, because prior to this, I had no experience. I had no idea what was going on. But they both had already grown quite a following at that point. So I was like, hey, I'm doing this series. And Drew's like, you should probably have a name or like a hashtag,
yeah,
for this series so people could brand it and find it and get to recognize it. So he's the one that came up with JHM Jams, putting those two together. He's like, alliteration is always nice.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it started with that name. Now, looking back, I wish I had picked something that's like easier to memorize or easier to say. I've run into a lot of issues where people can't remember the acronym,
yeah,
of the JHM, or they would skip a letter, or they would mix up the letters. And I'm like, man, this was really poor branding on my part. But, you know, at the time, I really did not plan for this to be such a big part of my life and to have it become such a brand. But I guess I can't really do the Juilliard House Mafia too publicly because, one, there's all the trademark copyright, you know,
yes,
with the school. So now when people just ask, I generally say like Japanese hungry man, which isn't, you know, like inaccurate, you know, it does describe myself, you know, funny. The Japanese hungry man jams, you know, which
yeah.
I feel like is still very true to who I am. And food is such a big part of my life. And I'm such a big foodie. And I have like a separate Instagram account called Japanese Hungry Man.
Okay.
Where I just post all the food that I eat and I just dump it all over there. So I guess it's what most people call kind of like a Finsta. But it's just like my happy place of just seeing all the food that I have consumed
yeah.
in my life. But
that's awesome. Well, let me ask you a couple questions then. Let's back up for a second. So first of all, shout out to Juilliard for opening this door for you. Who would have thought?
Yeah.
I mean, we all think of Juilliard as a very stuffy classical musical place with lots of other arts going on, but not necessarily opening a door into what you were doing. So that's super cool. The first question I have for you is, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Midwest, born and raised in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I started there, then I moved to Michigan around high school to study with a teacher there. And then after that, I moved to New York for college and grad school.
Okay, so you went to Juilliard for your bachelor's and your master's.
Correct.
And who did you study with there while you were there?
At Juilliard, I was with Richard Aaron.
Okay.
For all the degrees. So I guess all 6 years of my life there, it was just straight shot Richard Aaron.
Yeah. So, and I've noticed a lot of my colleagues, especially when we play pop shows, they really turn their nose up at it. They don't like doing it. They feel like it's beneath them. This isn't why I became a musician. I personally don't feel that way. I was raised in a house where classical music was on all the time. So when I raised my children, I decided that I would play pop music for them all the time because I didn't want to shove classical music down their throat. So I became enamored with all kinds of different pop music, just like you did, apparently. And actually, my kids are all grown now, and they're huge fans of EDM, so they have that in common. But I try to always keep an open mind and think about the different genres of music that we play, because an orchestra isn't just classical music like maybe it was 50 years ago. So it's all part of what we do. But I find there's not a lot of enthusiasm in the workplace for it. So how did you find your friends and colleagues at Juilliard were as being receptive to either working with you or listening to what you were putting out there?
Yeah, I think initially, I guess my interest came simply because my upbringing, my parents are both musicians in different capacities, but even them being classical musicians, a lot of the music that we were listening at home had quite the variety of the non-classical repertoire. So I already grew up with, I think, a taste for enjoying a variety of music and different kind of genres and styles. And I guess I went through Juilliard and like started recruiting people for this series. Obviously, you know, there were people that weren't that into it or not as interested, or as you've mentioned, maybe looked slightly down on this whole idea of crossover musician or pop music or anything other than the elite classical.
Yeah.
However, I think you come to find that a lot of people, even classical musicians, listen to music beyond just classical music.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was doing this in school, it, I think, offered to myself and for others a nice little break from what we were doing all day, every day. And it gave us a little bit of a fresh air and a little something else that didn't feel like we had to live up to the same kind of pressure and standards that we had been placing ourselves playing classical music. I think it's very common for us classical musicians for when we play any kind of classical repertoire, simply because we've been trained and we know the incredible potential of what this music is and how deep and how incredible it is. It sometimes crushes us with that amount of legacy that we feel like we have to live up to.
Yeah.
And constantly, I think being in that environment, especially in a place like a school, where that is like what you're live, breathing, and dying for day in, day out, I think can burn a lot of people out.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it ended up becoming a little bit more of like a self-therapy of sorts. So I wouldn't quit music altogether. And I was trying to find ways in which I could reconnect with the simple joys of playing music or jamming or reliving the fun environment and nature of what I used to enjoy about like a sight reading party, where you would just do it for the fun of it because you enjoyed it and not necessarily for the perfection of it or because you felt like somebody was judging. I think you probably have been in a lot of sight reading parties or of different kind of situations in which when you're playing in that environment, when you mess up, people laugh and you laugh and it's like, haha, like that was such a hard passage, but let's just keep going.
Yeah, you know, like exactly
kind of thing. And I really enjoyed that atmosphere of playing music for the sake of it and not so much because you had to or because you had to do this for a grade or for a recital or a degree requirement or because your lesson's coming up next week. So I try to create that environment in my sessions that I did through the pop covers of the chamber music, the fun, the social collaborative joys of being a musician. And I think being able to tap into the creative side of not having anything that was written down. So you had a lot more freedom and flexibility, which also felt like there were less things that felt like quote unquote wrong, since nothing wasn't really determined.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this then. When you sit down with these covers, who does all the arranging? Because I noticed you don't use any music or anything. You guys are just jamming. So you obviously already have a skill for improvising and sort of hearing things and playing by ear that I lack. I can play a lot of high level music that's on a page, but that's not a skill that I've ever been able to really develop. Was that something that already came naturally to you and then you guys would work together as a group? Or talk about the logistics of putting these together.
Yeah, for sure. The process in which this happens, I generally at least, you know, send the music choice beforehand or before the session. Nowadays, you know, in the very beginning, it used to be much more last minute. When this happens, the arrangement process generally happens in the session where we're all working collaboratively to decide, you know, generally like the important thing that gets decided is who's playing melody when, you know, and once we decide who's doing that, then whoever's not playing the melody plays the supportive role. And there are certain situations where if you have certain instruments, they are maybe much more adept to playing a rhythm section part. For instance, if I have like a jazz pianist, a drummer, and a bassist that come into a session, then their roles are usually like pretty set.
Yeah.
And they kind of know what to do. They know what their roles are. And then otherwise, whoever is left just kind of deciding who plays melody when. And then other than that, we decide on the, I guess, the creative elements of the arranging, whether if certain sections we change the feel for it, change the feel, the style, the groove, or do some reharmonization and change the chords to make it cool for us. And all of that is just a constant discussion as things are happening. When I book musicians, I generally have some kind of idea in my mind of, you know, let me grab some rhythm players. And then let me grab some melody players. But that's about it. I think the skill in which you develop doing this, I grew up studying the Suzuki method.
Okay.
And much of that in the beginning is learning by ear.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, it helped me get a jump start into training my ears of being able to learn things by ear, which has been really helpful. Yet when I guess really decided to go into learning complex pop tunes, it's hard. I mean, it's still tricky, but I think it's one of those things where fortunately it's a trainable skill for many musicians. Obviously, if a lot of your life has been reading out of a sheet music, then to do anything out of that is a little scary simply because we haven't been training that other element as much as we might have been with the visual information that we used to consume. And I love working, for instance, with jazz musicians for some of that reason. They're very good with picking things up with their ears and learning by ear and playing by ear because much of their life is that. And
yeah,
their level of chamber music playing is at such a high level, I think, which is super cool for a classical musician to constantly witness and see like the level in which they're really kind of tuning into each other to really respond and adapt to what other players are doing. And I think a lot of the classical musicians that I have worked with who are open to doing these kind of things are generally up for the challenge or will just listen to it nonstop constantly and just kind of try to like pick it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of those things that it is something that I think you can develop. It just maybe if you're not used to it, it takes a little bit of time.
Yeah.
But it is a possible thing and you will only really get better at it the more you do. I wasn't very good to start, but I've now done over like 560 some pop covers at this point. So I've put in a little bit of the repetition of using that skill.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's gotten a little bit easier now that I've clocked in the hours. But
so when you went to Juilliard and you started thinking about your career and path in classical music, what did you envision that was going to look like when you got out? And is it where you are now? It doesn't seem like that was necessarily your plan. So what was sort of your original plan? And talk about how that has morphed into what your life and career has become today.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is a relatively typical, probably, trajectory of a lot of classical musicians hope for. I wanted to be a professional string quartet musician.
Okay.
That was my hopes and dreams and my goals growing up and going into school. And that's also one of the reasons why I started cello in the first place is my parents being musicians, I constantly saw them play chamber music with each other and also with their friends. And I was jealous and it looked like a lot of fun and I wanted to join. So I picked up the cellos to eventually be able to play with them. Sometime after that, I joined a chamber music program called the Chamber Music Connection in Columbus, Ohio, where I made a lot of really great friends and I was placed in a string quartet there and discovered the joys of playing string quartet repertoire and being in that kind of collaborative, fun, social environment and did the classic string quartet competition circuits in high school and, you know, was really kind of gunning for that kind of career, ideally, and went into school, Juilliard, and I was like, all right, this is a great place for me to find like-minded people and find a string quartet, and we're going to dominate the world. The reality, unfortunately, wasn't as bright and shiny as I had hoped in the string quartet space. It was very hard to find like-minded people with like a similar passion and a trajectory and a goal. You know, it's like hard enough finding one partner or a spouse in life. But, you know, in a string quartet, you got to find three others aside from yourself. And I found that to be a little bit of a challenge. So by the time I graduated, I didn't really have a string quartet that wanted to exist beyond the graduation. And I was a little bummed. But I think it turned out fine. Now I'm not in a string quartet, but I'm in a trio. We're currently managed by the Concert Artists Guild in New York and gives me an opportunity to live the chamber musician life, go travel and perform. I'm like flying out to Florida today.
Oh, okay.
For more concerts.
This is the group Empire Wild.
This is the group Empire Wild, consisting of two cellos and a piano. So it's a little bit unusual, yeah. But a lot of the music that we play is non-classical and classical. So it kind of really lives right down my alley of my interests in music. And even outside from that, having my JHM jams, that's in and itself a chamber music project. And it's an ensemble that I constantly get to play with different people every week and with a lot of different instrumentalists or just artists that I normally wouldn't be able to collaborate with as a classical cellist. You know, for classical musicians, there's not maybe that many opportunities to regularly work with jazz musicians or pop singers or people, anybody outside of like a classical sphere on a regular basis. So I think it ended up existing in those two groups that I'm largely a part of now with Empire Wild and JHM Jams, where I'm now living those dreams of one day becoming a string quartet musician back then, but now manifesting in slightly different, I think, shapes and sizes, but still very much keeping the essence of what I enjoy about playing with others and collaborating and the chamber music aspect of being a cellist.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. You're kind of living this life of a lot of variety too in that, which I think is really special. Instead of really just playing string quartets, now you're sort of doing everything, which I think is cooler and probably may ultimately be more rewarding, having that kind of mix in your life. We had so much more to talk about that we split this episode into two parts. So be sure and catch part two of this interview, which we will release in 1 week. Thank you so much to Ken Kubota for joining us today and sharing his story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Ken and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecelosherpa.com. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was edited by Eric Begay at Red House Productions and produced and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.